back to the gloom, to the reek of moss and earth. Cleric began describing what they had seen, only to falter as his memories outran him. Akamian finished doing his best to sound indifferent, even though his heart still hammered. "Fucking hags!" Paquas exclaimed, his eyes bright with imagined mayhem. "Serves them. Serves them!" "You're missing the point," Galien said, staring at Akamian with solemn concentration. "Pox is right," Soma chimed in. "Good riddance." He turned, grinning. "I say we run 'em," Paquas cried. "Lop 'em and bail 'em." He looked at Soma and laughed. "Repay the favor in their own skin." "Fools!" Lord Cossiter spat. "Nothing will be run. Nothing!" The black-skinned giant turned to regard his captain with round-eyed outrage. Lord Cossiter's scrutiny, which was angry at the best of times, narrowed into a murderous squint. "Don't you see?" Galien said, imploring. Akamian could see the warning in the look he shot his Zayumi friend, as if to say, "Too soon, you press too soon." The question was whether the captain had seen it as well. Akamian glanced at Maimara and somehow knew she had sensed it as well. New lines had been drawn, and for the first time they were being tested. "The hags are bigger than any company, harder," Galien continued explaining. "That's how they can hunt the likes of us. If those skinnies lop them, then those skinnies can lop us." He let his voice trail into the significance of what he had just said. "If they catch our scent," Zongas said, nodding. "Did you say the skinnies were chasing the hags this way?" he asked the wizard. "Almost directly." The implication was plain. Sooner or later the Shrank would cross their trail. Sooner or later they would start hunting them, according to what Akamian had learned from the others. Scent was what made the creatures at once so deadly and so vulnerable. Laying trails to gull the Shrank into ambushes was the primary way scalpers hunted. But if the skinnies caught a company's spoor before they had time to prepare... "Fatwall," the captain said after a moment of furious meditation. "Same as before, except we slog it day and night. If we lose them, we lose them. If not, we chop it out there." "Fatwall!" Sorrow cackled, his gums blood red and glistening. His grins had seemed to eat up his whole face of late. "Latrine of the gods!" They skip-marched, as the scalpers called it. After that, hiked at a trot brisk enough to steal the wind for words. Once again, Akamian found himself fearing his age, so exhausting was the pace. For him, the years had accumulated like dry rot. The fabric of his strength seemed healthy enough, but only so long as it wasn't pressed or stretched. By the time the evening shroud climbed across the mop, the march had become a fog of petty miseries for him. Reeling breathlessness, stitches in his side, cramps in his left thigh, needles in the back of his throat. Dinner provided him with a brief respite. In truth, cleric and his dispension of curie was the only thing that interested him. Maimara slumped between the crooks, fluting the base of the nearest trunk, propped her elbows on her knees, and laid her face in her palms. Zongas, who seemed as tireless as cleric or the captain, set about preparing their measly repast, rank strips from a kill he had made 3 days ago. Others flopped across the soft humus, using fallen limbs and the like to support their heads. Akamian leaned against his knees, did his best to spit away the nausea welling through him. He peered through the darkness, searching for cleric and the captain. For whatever reason, the two of them always retreated a short distance from the others when they made camp. He would see them, whether high on a promontory or in a depression on the far side of a tree, cleric sitting, but with his head bowed in such a manner that seemed to be kneeling, while the captain, who so rarely spoke otherwise, muttered over him, grinding out words that he could never quite hear. Just one of many mysteries. The old wizard hacked out the last of the fire pooled in his lungs, then shuffled toward the two figures. Cleric crouched on his toes, his cheek pressed against his knees, while he listened with eyes both empty and black. The last of the remaining lights seemed to linger along the bare skin contours of his head and arms. Aside from his leggings and the tattered remains of a ceremonial kilt, he wore only his shirt of nymal mail, its intricate links always shining no matter how clotted with filth they became. The captain stood above him, discoursing in the same scarcely audible mutter. His hair hung listless across the splintered sections of his hauberk, ropes of black shot with gray. His pleated Aenanai tunic, threadbare at the beginning of their expedition, fairly reeked to look at, though a Commian could scarce smell anything above his own rotting garb. They both looked up, fixed him with twin gazes, one unearthly, the other not quite sane. A kind of anxiousness seized the moment.
"Kiri,"
a Commian said, shocked by the croak that was his voice.
I'm too old for this pace."
Without a word, the non-man turned to rummage through his satchel, one of the few things any of them had managed to carry out of Kilargis. He withdrew the leather pouch, and Akamian found himself hefting the thing in his soul, divvying pinches into the near and distant future. Cleric unknotted the drawstring, reached in with thumb and forefinger. But Lord Cossiter stayed him with a wave of his hand. Another pang plucked through the old wizard, this one colored with intimations of panic. "We need to speak first," the captain said. "Holy veteran to holy veteran." Akamian had the impression of a sneer over and above the contempt that generally ruled the man's expression. Something, a demoralizing wave, crashed through him. What now? Why did this mad fool insist on beating complexity and confusion out of simple things? He needed his pinch.
"By all means," the old wizard said stiffly. "What could be more simple than that?"
The captain regarded him with dead eyes. "The others," he finally asked. "What do they say?"
Akamian did his best to match the madman's glare.
"They worry," he admitted. "They fear we no longer possess the strength to reach the coffers." The captain said nothing. Thanks to the koray beneath his armor, void and menace throbbed where his heart should have been.
"So?" Akamian asked crossly. All he wanted was his pinch. "Does talk violate some rule of the slog as well?"
"Talk," the captain said, spitting to the left of his feet. "I care nothing for your talk." The man's smile reminded Akamian of the dead he had seen on the battlefields of the First Holy War, the way the sun would sometimes shrink the flesh of the face, drawing cadaverous grins on the fallen. "So long as you don't weep."
Shrank. The North means shrank.
She fled them in Kilargis, and now she flees them here, in the Mop, on the Endymion Heights, where everything turned on the Great Ordeal and the Second Apocalypse. Scarce a day passed without hearing something about the ancient North. So much so, she openly scoffed at its mention. She would actually say things like, "Oh, yes, the North," or "Sacarpus, you don't say." There was an absurdity to places far, a sense of insignificant people scratching meaningless earth. Let them die, she would sometimes think, whenever she heard tidings of famine in Aenon or plague in Nilnamesh. "What are these people to me, these places?" A fool, that's what she had been, a pathetic little slit. Their souls and their wind fortified with Kiri, the company fairly sprints across the pinching ground, even a Commian, who had been in obvious straits before Cleric and his medicinal pinch. The nonman leads, a Cyrillic point floating low and brilliant above his right brow. The illumination pulls their scissoring shadows out into the dark, alternately revealing the sinuous arch of limbs and falling into pockets too deep to reach. Where Kil'Augis had encased them at every turn, sealed them in impenetrable stone,
Now it seems they race through a void, that nothing exists beyond narrow corridors of earth, trunk, and branching lattices. Nothing. No murdering stone hags, no obscene shrank, no prophecies or armies or panic nations. Just the skin-eaters and rushing shadows. For no reason she can fathom, images from her old life on the Endymion Heights plague her soul's eye. Gilded folly, the further she travels from her mother, it seems, the more a stranger she becomes to herself. She cringes at the thought of her former self. The endless straining to stand aloof, the endless posturing, not to convince others, for how could they not see through her in some measure, but to assure herself of some false moral superiority. Survival, she realizes, is its own kind of wisdom. Scalper wisdom. She almost snorts aloud at the thought. But running, it seems nothing could be more true. All things perish. All things are weak, execrable. Nothing more so than the conceits of the perpetually wronged. A smile? Someone says. She turns and sees Soma pacing her, cast noble tall, lean and broad-shouldered, with his gowns torn and twisted. He resembles the disowned prince that the other girls used to dream about in the brothel, the fabled customer who would rescue rather than abuse. His dark-lashed eyes seem to laugh. There is a relentlessness to him that she does not quite trust, she realizes, a strength out of proportion to his foppish character. We all start laughing at some point, he says between breaths. She turns away, concentrates on what shreds of ground she can glimpse between shadows. On the long and hard trail she knows, a twisted ankle means death. Knowing how to stop, the man persists, that is the real trick of the slog. Unlike her sisters in the brothel, Maimara had despised men like Soma. Men who continually apologized with grand gestures and false concerns. Men who had to smother their crimes beneath pillows of silken guilt. She much preferred those who sinned with sincerity. Maimara, the man begins. She keeps her eyes averted. Soma is nothing to her, she tells herself. Just another fool who would grope her in the dark if he could, sticky his fingers with her peach. The world rises into the sphere of Cleric's light, then pours into oblivion. She peers at the oncoming ground as it vanishes into the shadows of those before her. Running. There is peace in flight, she realizes, a kind of certainty she never understood, as though she had known it her entire life. Running from the brothel, running from the mother who abandoned her there, these are fraught with doubt and worry and regret. The heart-cracking recriminations of those who run to punish, as much to flee. But running from Shrank. Her lungs are bottomless. The Kiri tingles through her thought, her limbs. She is little more than a feather, a mote, before the forces that inhabit her. And there is a thickness to it, an eroticism, being the plaything of enormities. I have the judging eye. Anasarimba Maimara marvels and laughs. Galien joins her, then Paquus, then the rest of the company, and for some reason it seems right and true, laughing while fleeing Shrank through a cursed forest. Then Cleric stops, his head bent as though listening. He turns to them. His face burns so bright beneath the Cyrillic point that he seems an angel, an inhuman angel. Something comes. Then they all hear it. To their right, the dull scuff and drum of someone running. The air whisks to the sound of drawn weapons. Squirrel is in her hand. A stranger staggers as much as leaps into existence, his hair tied into a Galeoth war knot. Blood slicks on his right arm. Exhaustion has beaten his panic into resignation. You can see it in his face. And Maimara realizes that her flight has yet to begin.
To flee, to truly run, is to throw yourself as this man has thrown himself, past effort and determination, to the convulsive limit of endurance. To run as they ran in Colossus. The man crashes into Galien's arms, bawling about something inarticulate.
"What's he saying?" the captain barks at Sorrow.
"Skinnies!" the withered sergeant cackles. "The skinnies are on them!"
"Sweet Seju," someone cries.
"Look!" Pakwas cries, peering into the blackness that had delivered the man.
"Look! Another light!"
Everyone, the newcomer included, turns in the direction the sword dancer indicates. At first they see nothing. Then it materializes, a floating point of white, appearing and disappearing to the rhythm of intervening obstructions. Sorcerous light. They glimpse figures as it nears, at least a dozen. More men, surviving stone hags. Even from the distance you can see their fear and haste. But something slows them. A litter, she realizes. They carry someone on a litter. The small mob passes behind the grand silhouette of a tree, and she glimpses the man they carry, the sorcerer. Galien and Pakwas are shouting. They've thrust the sobbing stone hag to his knees, as if preparing to execute him.
"No!" Akamian is crying. "I fought..."
"He's a hag!" Galien cries, as if mystified, as if summary execution is a courtesy compared with what the man deserves, a scalper who hunts scalpers. The captain pays no attention whatsoever, instead mutters to Cleric, who peers into the blackness behind the approaching party. She watches the bald head turn, the white face smile. She sees the glint of fused white teeth.
"Hags!"
Sorrow gurgles. His eyes are squeezed into crescents above his cheeks. The fugitives begin calling out as they approach, a cracked chorus of relief and desperate warning. Within heartbeats they blunder into the greater light of Cleric's Cyrillic point, terrified and bleeding. The litter is dropped. Some skid to their knees. Others raise abject hands before the weapons brandished by the skin-eaters. Maimara feels someone clutch her sword arm, turns to see Soma standing grim beside her. He means to give reassurance, she knows, yet she finds herself offended all the same. With a jerk she pulls her arm free.
"No time!" someone is screeching, one of the hags. "No time!"
All is argument and confusion. In the gaggle of shouts and voices, they fail to hear the loping approach. Now they stand rigid and peering, their ears pricked to the invisible rush. Twigs snapping, throats grunting, feet kicking. Maimara is dead. She knows this absolutely. She and Soma are standing on the periphery, several paces from the commotion of the latest arrivals, from Akamian and his life-preserving wards.
"To me!" she hears the old wizard cry.
She hears the inside-out mutter of sorcery, sees shadows tossed, lights plumbing, the barked blackness. They come howling out of the black, crude weapons held high and wide, faces twisted into ravenous sneers, streaming between trunks, unshod feet kicking up humus. The first flies at her like a thrown dog. She parries its crazed swing, ducks and strings the thing as it sails past her. Others follow a mere heartbeat behind. Too many blades, too many teeth. Then something impossible happens. Soma, somehow before her, when he had stood behind, somehow catching each raving creature in its instant. He does not fight as scalpers fight, matching skill against ferocity, hammering strength against wild velocity. Nor does he dance as Pakwas dances, trusting ancient patterns to parse the surrounding air. No. What he does is utterly unique, a performance written for each singular moment. He throws and snaps his body. He moves in rings and lines, so fast that only inhuman screams and slumping bodies allow her to follow the thread of his attack. Then it's over.
"My Mara!" Akamian is crying. She sees him fighting his way toward her. He clutches her tight against his rank robes, but she is numb to the smell as she is to everything else. She returns his hug out of reflex, all the while watching Soma standing above the twitching dead. Watching her.
She survived. He had glimpsed her stranded, had expected the worst, yet there she stood, utterly untouched. Holding her, the old wizard did his best not to sob in relief. He blinked at the panicked burning in his eyes. Exhaustion, it had to be.
They turned to the roar of the captain, who held the prostrate hag sorcerer upright. The infamous Paphorus. The man was at least as old as Kossider, but he possessed nowhere near the stature and strength. He was Ketii, though his unkept beard lent him a barbaric, nocerai countenance. His accent suggested Kengemis, or northern Kenraya. He swayed in the captain's grip, capable of standing on his left foot only. His right was bootless, bare and purpling. His foul leggings had been sawed open to the thigh, revealing blood-sopped bandages about his shin. When Akamian had first glimpsed him on the litter, he had assumed the man was simply wounded. But now he could see the leg was broken, severely broken. The length of his right shin was only two-thirds that of his left.
"Tell me!" Lord Kossider roared. With his left hand, he held the man up as much as by the hair as by the scruff of the neck. With his right, he held his koray before the ailing schoolman's face. The fact that the stone hag scarcely glanced at the thing told Akamian he was already dying. The other hags, some 11 of them, milled in gasping shock. They looked more like beggars than warriors. Most had shed their armor in their haste to flee, leaving them with only their winter-rotted tunics and leggings. Several were thin to the point of bulbous elbows and knees. These were the men he had seen descending the cliff face, Akamian realized.
4 clans, maybe more, the swaying hag was saying. Numerous, very aggressive.
More than one clan? Galien interjected. Are they mobbing? The horror was plain in his voice. A moment of silence.
Maybe, Paphorus said.
Mobbing? Akamian asked aloud.
A scalper's greatest fear, Paquus replied in low tones. The Skinnies usually war clans against clan, but sometimes they unite. No one knows why.
There was a cliff, Paphorus managed between gasps. Some climbed down after us, the ones you killed, but the rest backtracked, we think.
Your sort, the captain grated in disgust. He bent his face back to show the mayhem in his eyes. Come to flee the ordeal, is that it? Come to lord your power.
No, the man coughed.
The captain raised his koray as though inspecting a jewel, then, with a kind of casual malice, slammed the thing into the hag's mouth. Sparking light, the whoosh of transubstantiation. Akamian stood blinking, a burning pang where his breath should have been. He watched the salt replica of Paphorus fall backward. It thudded hard against the sponge-soft turf. The captain crouched, hunched over the petrified sorcerer. He seemed little more than an apish shadow, given the war of light and afterimage in the wizard's eyes. He pulled a knife from his boot, wedged the point into the salt cavity that had been the hag's mouth. He raised his elbow in a prying motion, cracked off the alabaster jaw. He retrieved his koray, then stood, glaring at everyone but Cleric.
"What's he doing?" My Mara whispered with alarm.
"I think he's recruiting," the old wizard replied, bracing himself against a deep shudder. As much as he despised my soon-sized schoolmen as mercenaries, he could not help but feel a certain kinship with the man. Nothing instills brotherhood like the sharing of vulnerabilities.
"Without—" he fell silent, feeling the bite of the captain's lunatic gaze. Lord Kossider prowled about the fugitive scalpers, scrutinizing them with a slaver's indifference. As miserable as the skin-eaters appeared,
The stone hags seemed even more wretched, starved and wounded and absolutely terrified.
"You dogs have a choice," he grated. "You can let the whore play number sticks with your pitiful lives."
A rare grin, sinister for the murder in his eyes.
"Or you can let me."
And with that, the stone hags ceased to exist, and the skin-eaters were reborn. Fugitive they ran, a bubble of light falling through pillared blackness. The trees seemed to claw at them with stationary malice, slow them with insinuations of frailty and doom. The hags, who had no kiri to brace them, cried out from time to time, begging them to stop, or at least slow their pace. But no one, not even a Kamian or Maimara, listened, let alone answered their pleas. This was the slog of slogs. The sooner they understood that, the greater their prospects for survival. The lesson was dear. Two of them fell behind, never to be seen again. Dawn rose in sheets of brightening green. The impenetrable black yielded to the murk of deep forest hollows. They encountered a surging river the scalpers called the Throat. It fairly raged with spring melt, the water brown with sediment, spouting white plumes where the current crashed against the boulders ere it rolled down from the mountains. The sunlight it afforded was welcome, but the glimpse of smoke in the distance apparently was not. "Fatwall," Zongus explained to a Kamian in Maimara. "It burns." They were forced to follow the river's thundering course several miles before finding a crossing. Even still, they lost another of the hags to the kicking waters. They plunged back into the mop, and its temple gloom, the mossed ground wheezing beneath their feet. As always, they found themselves craning their necks from side to side as if to catch some secret observer. A Kamian need only glance at the others to know they suffered the same plaguing sense as he did, as if they were the people hated, like the Mummer tribes that migrated across the three seas. Some fluke of the terrain delivered them back to the Throat, this time opposite the point they had first encountered it. Cleric bid them pause. "Listen!" he called over the white roar. A Kamian could hear nothing, but like the others he could see. On the far bank, through the screens of foliage stacked beneath the canopy's verge, he glimpsed shadows running. Hundreds of them, following the path they had taken downriver.
"Skinnies, boys!" Sorrow cried with a gurgling laugh. "Mobs of them! Didn't I promise you a chopper? Eh? Eh?"
They continued climbing, the grades at times so steep that thighs burned, and sputum flew. If the Kiri failed to whip them forward, then the glimpse of the Shrank, who pursued them, certainly did. Despite the profundity of their exhaustion, the sight of sunlight through the gallery ahead spurred them to a run. They found themselves at the mop's blinking edge, squinting across a slope of felled trees. Fatwall, the long-dead fortress of Enku Maimor. Maimor was the name that a Kamian had encountered only a few times in his dreams. The ancient Maori Empire had been little more than a tarp thrown across the fractious tribes of the eastern white Nocerai, and Maimor had been one of the several nails that held it in place over the generations, a high royal fastness which would house the High King during his seasonal tour of his more rebellious provinces. Like everything else during the first apocalypse, it had come crashing down in a hail of fire and shrank. The old wizard wondered whether a Maiorishman of yore would recognize what remained. The Maimor lost versus the Maimor cut from the wilderness some 2,000 years later. Fatwall. Trees had overgrown the ruined outer defenses, strangler oaks mostly. The great stumps yet stood, as tall as towers, clutched like fists about the foundations. The scalpers had incorporated them in their reclamation of the fortress, using them as ad hoc bastions. Elsewhere, they had raised palisades across the gaps and timber hoardings along the ruined heights. This was what smoked and burned, the flames all but invisible in direct sunlight. The skin-eaters lingered in the shadows, panting and peering. Something had attacked the fortress, and recently. Akamian heard Galien murmur, "Bad," to Pakwas, who towered at his side. Catching the old wizard's look, the former columnary said, "Skinny's behind us, and now Skinny's before us? This is more than just a mobbing." "Then what is it?" Galien shrugged in a scalper manner, as if to say, "We're all dead anyway." Akamian thought of these men, skin-eater and stone-hag alike, spending season after season letting blood in these wastes. They feared for their lives, certainly, but not the same as other men feared. How could they? Coin lost to the number sticks is far different from coin lost to thieves, even if the penury that resulted was the same. Scalpers knew the gamble. When nobody could discern any sign of friend or foe, the captain instructed Cleric to scout ahead. The non-men strode into the sky, his skin shining, his nimal hauberk gleaming. The mongrel company watched with exhausted wonder. He walked high over the slope of felled trees, receding until he was little more than a thin dash of black hanging over Maymore's ruined precincts. Veils of smoke wafted about him, drawn to the lazy west. The Osthwai Mountains loomed in the distance beyond, clouds massing about their summits. After several moments of peering, Cleric waved them forward. The company set across the boneyard of trees, following the zigzag of trunks like beached whales, picking their way through wickets of skeletal branches. At times it seemed a labyrinth. Open daylight offered Akamian another opportunity to appraise the newcomers, the hags, who seemed even more mangy and forlorn. They had the watchful look of captives, and the voices of slaves living in fear of a violent and mercurial master. Like the skin-eaters, they hailed from across the three seas, but who they were did not seem to matter, at least not to Akamian. They were stone hags, bandit scalpers who killed men to profit from strength. In a real sense, they were no better than cannibals, and perhaps even more deserving of death. But they were human, and in a land of mobbing shrank, that kinship trumped all other considerations. Any reckoning of their crimes would have to come after. Maymore's gate had collapsed into utter ruin long, long ago. A makeshift replacement had been raised across its uneven remains, a timber palisade untouched by the fires that smoldered elsewhere. The door stood open and unmarked. The company filed beneath the crude fortifications, gazing about in different directions. Akamian had braced himself for the sight of slaughter within. Few things were more disturbing than the aftermath of a shrank massacre. But there was nothing. No dead. No blood. No seed. "They fled," Zongas said, referring to the ministerial contingent that was supposed to be stationed here. "The Imperials! This is their work. They've evacuated." In some places the ruins spilled into gravel, while elsewhere they seemed remarkably intact. Hanging sections of wall, alleyways through waist-high remnants. Blocks breached the interior turf, scattered and heaped, creating innumerable slots and crevices for rats. Several more massive stumps hunched over and across the stonework, their roots splayed out in vein-like skirts, 2 stories high in some places. The fundamental layout of the fortress followed the ancient sensibility, where recreating some original model trumped more practical considerations. Even though the heights formed a distended oval, the walls were rectilinear. The citadel, in contrast, was round, forming the circle and square pattern that Akamian immediately recognized from his dreams of ancient Kelmiol, the lost capital of the Maori Empire, when Seswatha had stayed at the fortress of Enku Amor. The stone was pitted and multicolored, here black with molds, there frosted with white and turquoise lichens. What ornamentation that survived, though plain in comparison to Kilajus, seemed exceedingly elaborate by human standards. Every surface had been worked in patterns, animal totems for the most part. Beasts standing, their arms articulated in human-like poses. As numerous as the reliefs were, Akamian found only one intact representation of Maori's ancient crest, seven wolves arrayed like daisy petals about a shield. His whole body hummed, at once scraped of all strength and steeped of giddy vigor. Kiri. Despite everything, Akamian found himself gazing and wandering as he had so many years ago, lost in thoughts of times long dead. He had always found sanctuary in ruins, freedom from the demands of his calling, as well as connection with the ancient days that so tyrannized his nights. He had always felt whole in the presence of fragments.
Akka, Mamara called, her voice so like her mother's that goose pimples climbed the old wizard's spine.
A plaintive echo. He turned, surprised by his smile. This was her first time, he realized. Her first glimpse into the ancient Nosarai and their works. Remarkable, isn't it? To think ruins like this are all that remain of... He trailed, realizing that she looked at the others, not the ruined pockets climbing about them. She turned to him, her eyes pinned with indecision.
"Skin spy," she said in Ainanai.
"What?"
She blinked in momentary indecision. "Skin spy. Samandada. He's a skin spy."
"What? What are you saying?" Akamian asked, struggling to collect his thoughts. She was a princess imperial, which meant she had doubtless received extensive training regarding consult skin spies, who they were inclined to replace, and how they were apt to reveal themselves. She probably knew more about the creatures than he did.
"When the Shrank attacked," she continued under her breath, watching the Nilnameshi cast noble where he stood with the others. "Earlier, the way he moved."
She turned to the wizard, fixed him with a look of utter feminine certainty, as serious as famine or disease.
"What he did was impossible, Akka."
Akamian stood dumbstruck. A skin spy? Half-remembered passions galloped through him. The heat and misery of the first holy war. Images of old enemies. Old terrors. He turned to where the Nilnameshi stood.
"Soma!" he called, his voice rising thin.
"He saved my life," she murmured beside him, obviously every bit as bewildered as he was. "He revealed himself to save me."
"Soma!" Akamian called again.
The man spared him a sideways glance before turning back to the mutter of those about him. Conger, Pakwas. Akamian blinked, suddenly feeling very feeble and very old.
The consult? Here?
The entire time?
"He revealed himself to save me."
The confusion did not so much lift as part about necessity, leaving only naked alarm and the focus that came with it.
"Samandutta, I am speaking to you!"
The affable brown face turned to him, smiling with... An Odaini concussion cant was the first thing to the old wizard's lips. Without warning, Soma leapt over the milling scalpers, boggling eyes and snuffing voices. He twisted mid-air with an acrobat's grace, landed with the scuttling fury of a crab. He was two-thirds across the courtyard before Akamian had finished. He leapt, sailing over the ruined wall as the cant smashed stone and scabbed mortar. The company stood pale and uncomprehending.
"Let that be a warning,"
Sorrow cackled in abject glee. He turned to the hags, as if they were unkempt cousins requiring lessons in genanic etiquette.
"Steer clear the peach, lads."
He glanced at Akamian, his eyes possessing enough of the old canniness to unnerve the old wizard.
"What the captain doesn't cut, the schoolman blasts!"
They slept in bare sunlight. It was proper, since nothing was as it should be. Battling men instead of Shrank, taking refuge in a fallen fortress, finding a skin spy in their midst, then saying nothing of it. The Kiri had faded, and despite the longing looks, the non-men kept his pouch hidden in his satchel. Of exhaustion's many modalities, perhaps none is more onerous than apathy, the loss of sense and desire, where you wish only to cease wishing, where mere breathing becomes a kind of thoughtless toil. Akamian's sleep was fitful, plagued by flies, the biting kind, and worries too numerous and inchoate to resolve into anything comprehensible. Soma, the Shrank pursuing them, the captain, Cleric, Maimara, the dead in Kilalgis, his lies, her curse, and of course Kellis, and Esmenet. Fire and their lack of numbers had convinced Lord Cossiter that the outer walls were indefensible, so they had retreated to the shattered citadel. At some point the structure had collapsed inward, leaving only the great blocks of the foundation intact. Centuries of vegetation had choked the inner ruin with uneven earth, so that the remaining walls, which towered the height of 3 men along their outer faces, climbed only chest-high for those standing within. The scalpers salvaged what they could find, those few trifles left behind by the retreating Imperials, as they called them. Then they climbed into the citadel's earthen gut to await the inevitable. The subsequent vigil was as surreal as it was forlorn. While the rest dozed in what shade they could find, Cleric took position on one of the great blocks, sitting cross-legged, gazing over the ruins below, across a field of felled trees, to the mop's black verge. Akamian actually found comfort in the sight of him, a being who had survived, who knew how many sieges and battles, back into the mists of history. The non-man waited until late afternoon to begin his sermon, when the air had cooled enough and the shade had grown enough to provide the possibility of real sleep. He stood on the lip and turned to regard them below, his slim and powerful figure bathed in light. The sky reached blue and infinite beyond him. Akamian found himself watching and listening the way others watched and listened. "Again, my brothers," he said in impossibly deep tones, "again we find ourselves stranded, trapped in another of the world's hard places." Stranded, a word like a breath across a dying coal. Stranded, lost with none to grieve them. Trapped. "Me," the non-man continued, letting his head sag, "I know only that I have stood here 1,000 times over 1,000 years, more. This is my place, my home." When he looked up, his eyes glittered black for fury. A snarl hooked his colorless lips, "Wreaking destruction on these perversions. Atoning, atoning." This last word rang metallic across the stone, sent ever-dwindling echoes across the heights. Roused, several of the skin-eaters mouthed their approval. The stone hags simply gaped. "And this is your place as well, even if you loathe numbering your sins." "Yes," Sorrel coughed out over the rising clamor. His eyes were slits for his grin. "Yes!" That was when the inhuman baying began, a few throats cascading into 100. 1,000, rising from the mop below. Shrank. Akamian and the others leapt to their feet. They crowded the wall beneath Cleric, and to a man peered at the forest verge a half-mile or so to the south, and saw nothing save lengthening shadows and boundaries of scrub bathed in sunlight. The inhuman chorus dissolved into a cacophony of individual shrieks and cries. Birds bolted from the canopy.
1,000 times over 1,000 years,
Cleric cried. He had turned to face the mop, but otherwise stood as exposed as before.
Akamian glimpsed his shadow falling long and slender across the ruins below.
You live your life squatting, shitting, sweating against your women. You live your life fearing, praying, begging your gods for mercy.
Begging. He was ranting now, swaying and gesticulating, with a kind of arrhythmic precision. The setting sun painted him with lines of crimson. Unseen throats howled and barked across the distance. A second congregation.
You think secrets dwell in these mean things. The truth lies in the toes you stub, the scabs you pick, because you are small. You cry. Revelation! Revelation hides in the small!
The black gaze fixed Akamian, lingered for a heartbeat or two.
It does not.
The words pinched the old wizard deep in the gut.
Revelation rides the back of history, Cleric said, sweeping his eyes to the arc of the horizon, to the innumerable miles of wilderness. The enormities! Race! War! Faith! The truths that move the future!
And Cariel looked down across his fellow scalpers, his awe-struck supplicants. Even Akamian, who had lived among the Kunaroi, a Seswatha, found himself staring in dread and apprehension. Only the captain, who simply watched the mop with grim deliberation, seemed unmoved.
"Revelation rides the back of history," the Nonman cried, bowing his head to the failing sun.
The light etched the links and panels of his nimal, so that he appeared garbed in trickles of glowering fire.
"And it does not hide."
In Cariel, he seemed something wondrous and precarious. Ishroy and refugee both. Ages had been poured into him, and poured, overflowing his edges, diluting what he had lived, who he had been, until only the sediment of pain and crazed profundity remained. The sun waxed against the distant peaks, hanging in reluctance, or so it seemed, sinking only when the watchers blinked. It rode the white iron curve of a mountain for a moment, then slipped like a gold coin into high stone pockets. The shadow of the world rose and descended across them. Dusk. All eyes turned to the ragged crescent of the tree line, to the grunting hush that had fallen across the distance. They saw the first shrank creep pale and white from the bowers, like insects feeling the air. A savage crescendo rifled the air, punctuated by the moan of urgent horns. Then the rush. They came as they always came, shrank, no different from the first naked hordes that surged across the fields of Pir-Pahal, in an age that made far antiquity young. They came over the slope to felled trees, sluicing between the trunks, racing across barked backs. They came through the palisade gate, thronging across the ancient courtyards, braiding the wall's ruined circuit with gnashing teeth and crude weapons. They came, and they came, until they seemed a liquid, streaming and breaking, spitting an endless spray of arrows. The blue and violet of the evening sky faded into oblivion, leaving only the starry dome of night. The nail of heaven glittered from raving eyes, gleamed from notched iron. The scalpers huddled behind what few shields they possessed, shouted curses, while Cleric and the wizard stood upon the wall's disordered summit. All was screaming destruction below, monochrome madness. The men gagged on the porcine smoke, and they watched, knowing that they witnessed something older than nations or languages, a Gnostic sorcerer and a Kuya mage, singing in impossible voices, wielding looms of incandescence in wide, swinging arms. They saw hands glow about impossible dispensations. They saw light issue from empty air. They saw bodies pitched and prized and burned, burned most of all, until the ground became croaking charcoal.
And Cariel had spoken true. It was a mighty thing, a sight worthy of the pyre. A revelation.